Morning, good morning. I'd like to have a look this morning at a particularly interesting dimension of Hanukkah. This is meant to be a shiur about the Vilna Gaon and his contemporaries. And in fact, this topic that I'm going to mention this morning was in fact a discussion and an issue which was discussed by the Vilna Gaon, particularly with one of his famous contemporaries, about whom I have not yet spoken much, which is the Chassam Sofer, Rav Moshe Sofer, who was a slightly younger contemporary of the Vilna Gaon. He was, of course, the posek in Hungary, and the Rosh Yeshiva, and very much in many ways, a total contrast to the Vilna Gaon in so many ways, because as I've mentioned so many times before, the Vilna Gaon was really a recluse. He really was he never took any public position. He was a tzaddik and a Talmud Chacham of the highest caliber, the likes of which the Jewish people hadn't seen for centuries. But he was not a public speaker, he wasn't a public person. And he didn't lead from the front. He led from behind the screen of his own privacy. And that was a very special, but he had a small circle of selected, extremely talented disciples. And through them, his influence went out through the whole of Europe. But the Chassam Sofer, totally contrast, Chassam Sofer was not only the Rav of his city, he was also a Rosh Yeshiva, he was also the Posek. Rosh Yeshiva, Chassam Sofer wrote hundreds and hundreds of Shailas and Tshuvas, of responsa, of answers to contemporary questions. The Vilna Gaon never wrote a single letter. We didn't have a single letter from the Vilna Gaon. He never wrote any response at all. He didn't engage with contemporary questions at all. Chassam Sofer also trained many hundreds of Rabbonim who went out then to be a Rabbonim in the Shtetlach of Ukraine and Hungary and Czechoslovakia and Poland and Russia. Lots of them were the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon. And in that way, his influence was massive. The Vilna Gaon himself was a great admirer. Sorry, the Chassam Sofer was a great admirer of the Vilna Gaon. But he had a completely different style. And I'm going to come to show you a bit of a discussion and a debate on a particular aspect of Hanukkah. But in order to do so, let me give you a little bit of an introduction about the relevant point of Hanukkah. One of the most, if you like, difficult issues regarding Hanukkah is that we don't have any text about Hanukkah. It's the only yontif in the Jewish calendar about which we don't have a formal text. Every yontif, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, even Purim, we have a text in the Tanakh. Even Purim has got Megillas Esther, right? Hanukkah doesn't have a text anywhere. There is nothing in the Tanakh about about the Hanukkah story. And on a simple level, one could simply say that historically, since the Hanukkah story took place halfway through the Second Temple period in the second century BCE, the Hanukkah story actually took place after the Tanakh had already been sealed. In other words, it was past the closing date. But I don't think that's the real reason, as we'll see in a minute. Now, I say we don't really have a text, but of course there is a text, which is called the Book of Maccabees. I don't know if anybody here in the Shia has ever seen or read the Book of Maccabees, but the Book of Maccabees, Maccabees 1 and Maccabees 2, is not part of our Tanakh, even though it was around at the time, but the Chachamim, Chazal, the authors of the Mishnah, did not see fit to include the Book of Maccabees into the Tanakh, and that's an interesting issue. Why didn't they? We'll have a look at that as we go along. On a simple level, again, the Book of Maccabees was written originally in Greek and not in Hebrew, and it was seen as a historical document rather than Kitvei Kodesh. The Tanakh was Kitvei Kodesh, was texts of a certain sanctity, right? Texts which represented the spiritual and moral message of Klal Yisrael, and the Book of Maccabees didn't do that. The Book of Maccabees was a chronicle of the battles and the politics of the period, and remains for us an important historical source for understanding the events of Hanukkah. The other important historical source are the writings of Josephus, a famous Jewish historian, who also tells us a lot of details about the Hanukkah story, but again focuses on the the battle and the events surrounding the revolt of the Maccabees. Just as a footnote, I'd like to mention that the word Maccabee itself is a mystery. No one is quite sure where that word comes from. Mem Kaf Beis Yud is a well-known word in modern Israel. Maccabee is a football team. Maccabee is a sports center. Maccabee is a health insurance company. There's so many different Maccabees around, all come from the Hanukkah story, and yet we don't really know what it means. First of all, it's a mistake to think there were Maccabees. There weren't Maccabees, there was one man, the eldest son of Matisyahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol, who was Yehuda Maccabee. And he was the leader of the revolt against the Greeks. We'll talk a bit more about that in a moment. And he called himself Maccabee, and no one's sure why he called himself Maccabee. Has anybody here like to add something? Or what have you heard about the word Maccabee? Any offers on the word Maccabee?
It's a hammer.
Right, okay.
The one interpretation is the word Maccabee means a hammer. And he called himself Yehuda the Hammer simply because anybody who got in his way was severely hammered by him, right? He was a really powerful military leader, and he was the hammer. Okay, fine. Any other offers? Right, thank you. There is also a suggestion that it is an acrostic. It's Rosh Tevis, Mem Kaf Beis Yud, of Mi Chomoicha Bo'elim Hashem. Who can compare to you, God, as a power? Meaning, we are fighting, representing the power of God as opposed to the power of the Greek Empire. I don't believe there's any really a reliable source that that's the meaning of the word Maccabee, but it makes sense, and it could well be that that was his war cry, or maybe that was the way in which he encouraged his followers to follow him. Any other offers of Mem Kaf Beis Yud? Okay, so there is another offer about an acrostic. Mem Kaf Beis Yud could mean Matisyahu Cohen Ben Yochanan. Right? If you pay attention to the opening words of the Al HaNisim, Bimei Matisyahu, right? Bimei Matisyahu Ben Yochanan Cohen Gadol, that in actual fact, the father of all the five sons who led the revolt was Matisyahu. And he was a Matisyahu Cohen Ben Yochanan. Mem Kaf Beis Yud, Matisyahu Cohen Ben Yochanan. And I think probably that's the most reliable reason why he was called Maccabee. Somebody has just texted me that the famous or infamous, depending on your politics, the late Meir Kahana also was Meir Kahana Ben Yochanan, Mem Kaf Beis Yud, and he also liked to be connected to the Maccabees. And he was certainly a hammer. There's no question about that. Depending on your politics, whether you like him or hate him, he was certainly an interesting figure in modern Jewish history.
But Yochanan was not the son of, but Yehuda was not the son of Yochanan. That would make it good for.
No, but he was fighting under the instructions of his father. And his father was Matisyahu Cohen Ben Yochanan. In other words, when he called himself Maccabee, he was simply emphasizing his lineage to being the eldest son of his father, who was Matisyahu Cohen Ben Yochanan. Okay, that's so much for the name Maccabee, but also I bring it as simply a little bit of an illustration of the fact that we have no texts. If we would have a Megillah like we have for Purim, or we would even have a Mishnah. So if we'd have a Mishnah, we've mentioned Maccabee, we'd have Rashi telling us what Maccabee means. We don't have any text because we have no commentaries. we need to rely on historical sources and speculate. And here comes a very interesting question, which I'm going to be looking at during this shiur. And that is, okay, I understand why there's no posuk in the Tanakh about Hanukkah, because it happened historically a bit later than the period of the Tanakh. But why is there no Mishnah? There should be a Mishnah. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi edited the Mishnah in the second century, and he gave us the entire Shishul Sidri Mishnah, and he gave us a whole volume, a whole Masechta about Pesach, it's Pesachim, a Masechta about Yom Kippur, it's Yumah and Rosh Hashanah, and Masechta about Purim, which is Masechta's Megillah. Why didn't he give us Masechta's Hanukkah? Should have given us a Masechta. And this actually is a question that has exercised the minds. What happened? Why did Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi not write down a Mishnah? So if he's no Mishnah, how do we know all the halachas of Hanukkah? It's because the Gemara, which is a couple of hundred years later than Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, 300 years after Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, the Gemara discusses something else completely, which we'll be looking at in a moment. Tells us the full story of the battles and the politics of the era. But one thing the Book of Maccabees does not refer to at all, and that is the miracle of the little jug of oil that lasted for 8 days, and doesn't refer to the mitzvah of lighting the menorah on Hanukkah. It just tells us the history. So here you have a very interesting situation where really we have, in a sense, two different stories about Hanukkah. One story is simply the historical chronicle of the time, and the other is Chazal in the Gemara. And I was about to say that Chazal, where do they discuss this? There's a famous second chapter of Maseches Shabbos, which is called Bame Madlikin. Why do I call it famous? Because many shuls have got the minhag of reading Bame Madlikin in shul on Friday night. Bame Madliki means what are the permitted wicks and oils to be used for what? For Neiros Shabbos, that there's a mitzvah of lighting the lights of Shabbos, and only certain wicks and oils were used and other wicks and oils were not used. I'll come back to that in a moment. Apropos the lights of Shabbos, the Gemara starts discussing the lights of Hanukkah. And that's the only source in the whole of Shas where we know about lighting the menorah, the brach on the menorah, how many candles to light, where to put the menorah. All these halachas are contained where? In Maseches Shabbos. And they come in almost derech agav. They come in apropos the lighting of the candles of Shabbos. Suddenly we have the candles of Hanukkah. Surely Hanukkah deserves much more of a higher status, and there should be Mishnayos about Hanukkah. And this was a bit of a debate and a discussion that Bill Nagon and the Chasam Sofer discussed this at some length. I don't actually have the texts to show you, but I will look at that in a moment. But this is an interesting question I'd like to raise at the beginning of the Shia, and we'll give some answers to it as we go along. But it's important to understand that Hanukkah for us is, if you like, a blend between the Gemara in Maseches Shabbos, which tells us all the do's and don'ts of Hanukkah, how to celebrate Hanukkah and how to light the menorah and the brachos to be made, all the different details of Hanukkah, how many lights to light, etc. And then we have the Book of Maccabees, which is a very nice historical document, which we have to somehow bring into the picture in order to fill out the whole picture. It's interesting to note, incidentally, by the way, that the story of the battle, right, we don't ignore it completely, because in our davening and in our benching throughout Hanukkah, we say the Al HaNisim, and the Bracha Al HaNisim actually only mentions the battle. And interestingly, the Al HaNisim doesn't mention at all the Nes Pach HaShemet, the miracle of a jug of oil that lasted for 8 days. It's not mentioned in Al HaNisim at all. So whoever wrote the Al HaNisim wrote it in order to, in a sense, to reset the balance a little bit. Yes, we have the story of the jug of oil that lasted 8 days, and that's the if you like, supernatural moment of the whole event, but we also have, right, the battle that was fought against the Yevonim, Mosato Giborim Biad Haloshim, Rabbi Biad Ma'atim, Tmeim Biad Daorim, and this goes to some length, telling us the remarkable circumstances of a victory against the Greeks where we were heavily outnumbered. Okay, so these are really, in a sense, if somebody asks you what's the story of Hanukkah, the answer is we have two stories of Hanukkah. One story is about a little jug of oil that had miraculous powers. That's one story. And that's the story the kids in kindergarten love completely. But Judaism is also Judaism for adults, not just Judaism for children. And Judaism for adults has to recognize the fact that the real nace of Hanukkah happened on the battlefield. And then the question is, why did Chazal really emphasize so much the jug of oil that lasted and lasted and the lighting of the menorah? So I'd like to say from the outset, we'll develop this more as we go along, from the outset, this is a very, very interesting example, very, very interesting example of how history needs to be interpreted and is interpreted in different ways in different cultures. So for example, in the authors of the Sefer HaMakabim interpreted the history of the time in terms of military heroes, military victories, political victories, and the establishment of the new Hasmonean dynasty of kings. That's how they interpret it. Chazal did not want that Hanukkah should be a festival of military victories. Chazal wanted to understand that Hanukkah was a different type of victory. It was a victory. Indeed, there was a battle which took place on the battlefield, but there was another battle that was going on, which was the real battle that Chazal saw was the going forward into history and even into the 21st century. There's another battle going on, which is a clash of civilizations, what is called the Kulturkampf, between Athens and Jerusalem, between the values of the Greeks, the lifestyle, the values, the priorities of the Greek culture versus the lifestyle, the values, and the priorities of the Jewish Torah culture. This battle was really the battle that Hanukkah is about. And it's true there was a battle there were confrontations on the battlefield, but actually the importance of Hanukkah lies in the way in which the Jewish people at that time resisted the tremendous temptation and the tremendous even seduction of the beauty of Greece. Greece was not a barbaric, violent culture. Greece was the most beautiful and sophisticated and attractive culture, bar none, in the history of the world. That Greece produced architecture and literature and philosophy and music and mathematics and science and astronomy and all types of values which are still very much with us today in the Western world of the 21st century. The secular world in which we live, if we drill down deep to its roots, is a Hellenistic culture. The worship of physical health and physical beauty, the worship of academic studies and art for art's sake, the beauty for beauty's sake, that truth is beauty and beauty is truth, is all a Greek philosophy. It's got nothing to do with Torah at all. The Torah view is that beauty is very nice, aesthetics can be very attractive, but it's never an end in itself. In the Torah, from a Torah perspective, and this is an interesting topic for Hanukkah, generally speaking, that from a Torah perspective, we say Sheker Hachein VeHevel HaYofi Isha Yiras Hashem Hitis Halal, which means what? That beauty belongs in the world of appearances, belongs in the world of perception. Beauty does not necessarily relate to the essence of an event or the essence of a person. A person can be extremely beautiful and yet have a corrupt and evil soul. the soul of a person. It's the pnimius of an individual and the values and the dedication of a person, which is of the essence, right? And that's really, the Torah is focused not on chitzonius, not on the world of appearances, but on the world of the essences, the world of the soul, the world of the neshama. And that is really, was one of the cultural battles between Judaism and Athens at the time. And the and it was that which motivated the Maccabim, Yehuda Maccabee and his brothers, under the instruction of their father, Mattisyahu Kohen Gadol, to go out and fight against the Greeks, because the Greeks wanted to completely suppress Torah and mitzvahs, right? In order to make Hellenism the, not just the dominant culture, but the uniform culture throughout the Greek empire. That's what they wanted. And that was simply the new emperor, Antiochus IV, who called himself Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes, Epiphanes simply means God made manifest. In other words, he saw himself as a divine being. Obviously not an extremely modest individual, you can imagine that, right? Somebody who really understood. He saw himself as divinity embodied, right? As God in this world. And therefore his views, which were Hellenistic views, had to be not just recommended, but actually forcibly imposed on everybody in the Greek empire. The fact that Klal Yisrael resisted the Greeks and were willing to fight in order to remove the Greeks from Eretz Yisrael, from the land of Israel, that in itself was motivated by the Yirat Shamayim, by the spiritual motivation of Mattisyahu Kohen Gadol. He instructed his sons and all the Kohanim to follow him into battle. I'd just like to point out, of course, that we have to understand when you're telling the Hanukkah story, what an amazing sight it must have been in the eyes of the rest of the Jewish people, even just to see a Kohen holding a sword. Because Kohanim, throughout the history of Klal Yisrael, were never allowed to fight in battles. The whole tribe of Levi were exempted from all military service because they weren't allowed to come into contact with dead people, to come into contact with any tumah. To see a Kohen holding a spear, holding a sword, was a complete anathema, right? And it was completely forbidden according to all the laws of the Kohanim. Was completely forbidden. And yet they understood, Eis Lasos Lashem, that this was a moment in history which, if they didn't do it, it could spell the end for the whole of Jewish life in Israel. Why? Why? Because the power of the assimilation into the Greek culture was so massive. We have today, sadly, also massively high rates of assimilation into Western culture, intermarriage and assimilation. You just step one foot outside of the completely frum Torah world, and the percentages of intermarriage and assimilation are mind-boggling. Right? That phenomenon started with the Greeks. There were the Yevonim, there were the Greeks, and then there were what I referred to as the Mityavnim. The Mityavnim were the Hellenized Jews who had embraced the Hellenistic culture and had abandoned Shabbos and Bris Milah and Kashrus and Jewish life in order to embrace this beautiful, aesthetically inspiring world of the Greeks. So what we've got here is two battles happening simultaneously. You have the battle which is fought with swords and spears on the ground, and you have the clash of civilizations, the clash of cultures between Athens and Jerusalem happening in the hearts and minds of the Jewish people. And there was a miracle, and the miracle was that Klal Yisrael were not swept up and swept into Hellenism and swallowed up by it completely, despite the fact that lots of Jews, in fact, were Hellenized in a very, very real way. Incidentally, one of the untold stories of Hanukkah, it's not a story that is told to our children in Cheder, and because it's not taught in Cheder, we often as adults miss this point of the story, is that a very sad aspect of the Hanukkah battle was that it wasn't only a battle between the Jew and the non-Jewish enemy. It was also a civil war within the Jewish people, between the Kohanim, representing Matisyahu and Jewish life, against the Misyavnim, against the Hellenized Jews. And in fact, lots of people who were killed in the battles were Hellenized Jews. It was a civil war. We don't like talking about that, because a civil war is a very painful thing. And in fact, it was quite rare in Jewish history to have Jews literally killing Jews in the battlefield in wartime. But that was the truth of this battle. And maybe an additional reason why, in fact, the military victory of Hanukkah was downplayed by Chazal. Chazal decided, and this was something I want to suggest to you, that the decision of the Chazal, meaning the authors of the Mishnah, the Sanhedrin, the people at the time, don't forget, there was a period of Hillel and Shammai, Yosef ben Yochanan, and Yosef ben Yoezer, was a time of the early Tanaim. They decided, right, that the military situation was so complicated and so controversial that Hanukkah is not going to be about that, and therefore, Book of Maccabees we're not going to include in the Tanakh. We're not going to include it because that story is not a story which will build up the Jewish people. We're not saying it didn't happen, but it's not a story that will build up a Jew. There's even a hint to it in Alan Nissim, because when we speak about the miracle of the military victory, we say Mosata Giborim Biad Chaloshim, Rabin Biad Ma'atim. Okay, so that's military, that we fought against a greater force. We were successful against the great force of the Greek. Rabin Biad Ma'atim, the few against the many, the weak against the strong, right? But then it says Tameim Biad Tahorim. What does that mean, Tameim Biad Tahorim? What does that mean? Tome and Tahor are categories referring to Jews, not referring to the Goyim. It means the Tameim were the Jews who had abandoned Judaism, were the Tameim, and the Tahorim were the Kayanim. And the Tameim Biad Tahorim was a disaster, right? But that was part of the Hanukkah story. What I'd like to have a look now at something, I'm going to come at this issue from an interesting angle, and I want to learn with you an interesting topic. Let me begin with a 1 minute introduction, and I'm going to take you back to the end of the book of Bereishis, when Yaakov Avinu is on his deathbed, and he finally gives brachas in Parshas Vayechi. He gives brachas to all his children one by one, right? And each bracha is different, as the pasuk says, "Ish asher kebirchoso beirachoso." He gave each one a bracha suitable for him. One of the brachas he gave was to Yehuda. Okay, you have to follow this a little bit. We're going to look at the text in a minute. Yehuda gets a bracha, and in the bracha he's told that Yehuda will receive the malchus, that David HaMelech will come from Yehuda, eventually the Mashiach will come from Yehuda. Yehuda represents malchus. Right, he was the ultimate leader of Klal Yisrael. Hoiso Yehuda Lekodcho Yisrael Mamshalosov. Yehuda led the way. Why was Nachshon ben Aminodov the one who jumped into the Yamsuf first? Because he was the Nossi of Yehuda. He was the prince of Yehuda, and Yehuda was the leader. He was the king. Right, the king who didn't ask what are other people doing. He decided what needs to be done, and he did it himself. So that's Nachshon ben Aminodov. Let's have a look now at a very important Ramban. Okay, so can you see a text? Give me a thumbs up if you can see a text. Yes, you can see a text, thank you. Okay, so I want you to have a look at this phrase. So Yaakov Avinu says, Lo Yosur Shevet Yehuda. He gives Yehuda the Shevet. The Shevet means the staff, the scepter of royalty. And he says in his in his last will and testament, the scepter of royalty shall not depart from Yehuda. Umechokek mibein raglav. And the mechokek means a mechokek in modern Hebrew as well. A mechokek is someone who is the legislator, who makes the laws of the country. Comes from the word chok, which means, right, the statute, a law. So mechokek ben raglav. So the mechokek from among his descendants, ben raglav means his descendants, or it means his talmidim, ad kiyovo shilo, is an interesting reference to Shilo. I know at least one person listening to this shiur has got a special feeling about Shilo. We all know that Shilo is a city in the Shomron, where the Mishkan lived for many, many years. And the pasuk here, which, now Yaakov Avinu, of course, is speaking centuries before anything at all happens in the town of Shilo. Nevertheless, the pasuk uses the word Shilo as a reference to Mashiach. Ad ki yovo Shilo v'lo yikas amim, until Mashiach arrives, right? And when Mashiach arrives, then everybody will pay tribute to Yehuda. Why? Because Mashiach himself will be a descendant of Yehuda, right? As Tzemach David Avtecho Mehera Tatzmiach. The David HaMelech is the source of our messianic dream. But the messianic dream of David HaMelech didn't start with David, it started with Yehuda. Right? Yehuda was made into the king. There are all sorts of, excuse me one second. Don't forget, this is a complicated subject in Parshas Vayechi, because Yehuda is really the fourth child. There's Reuven, Shimon, Levi come before Yehuda, right? Nevertheless, and really, Yaakov should have given the Malchus, the kingdom, to the eldest. But for various reasons, both Reuven, Shimon, and Levi disqualified themselves, and therefore Yehuda is decided. So Yaakov gives Yehuda this bracha. So what does it say here? It says that the kings have to come from Yehuda. And now I want to learn with you a few lines from the Ramban on that pasuk, right? The Ramban Nachmanides, right, writing in the 1200s. So he is one of the prominent commentaries on the Chumash, and he brings in something amazing. So you can read it in the Hebrew or you can follow in the English. So he says, V'zeh hoya onesh hachashmanoi. If you learn this pasuk properly, you can understand the punishment of the Hasmonean kings. What's he referring to? So first of all, he's referring to, I'll mention in a minute, he's referring to the fact that the Hasmonean dynasty lasted only for about a century and a half, and then they were all wiped out. Nobody was left from the Hasmonean dynasty at all. By the time Herod gets on the throne, all the Hasmonean dynasty has been completely obliterated. And the sons of Matisyahu were didn't live very long. They were all killed in warfare. So he says, Shemolchu Babayis Sheini. Says, what was the great sin of the Hashmonaim? Was that in the second temple, right, in the second temple period, so I've written it here, for taking the crown for themselves. So here comes Matisyahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol, the great hero of the Hanukkah story, and his five sons, led by Yehuda Maccabee. They successfully revolt against the Greeks and get them out of the country. Miraculously, they're victorious. Miraculously, we light the menorah. And that's the good news. The bad news is, and the next step is, what they do is, they then say, right, we've won the battle. We are going to, the family of Matisyahu ben Yochanan, we are going to become the new royal family of Israel. We are going to become Malchus. And they founded the Hasmonean dynasty, right? The dynasty of Hashmonoi kings, one after another, right? Says the Ramban, that was an Avera. What was the Avera? The Avera was this pasuk. And Yaakov Avinu had said, Lo Yosor Shevet Mi Yehuda. No one is allowed to take Malchus away from Yehuda. Yehuda and the descendants of Yehuda in every generation, they represent legitimate royalty in the land of Israel. And anyone who takes it away from them is in violation of the instructions of Yaakov Avinu. Now, this is a massive critique of the Chashmonaim. And again, I'm bringing this here again as another reason why the Book of Maccabees was not included in the Tanakh, because the Book of Maccabees actually was the story of the battles and the victories were responsible for doing something which was an anathema to Jewish values, which was to have somebody other than Yehuda on the throne. I'd like to mention just in passing that it wasn't only the fact that the Chashmonaim were not from the tribe of Yehuda that was the problem, but that they were from the tribe of Levi. In other words, of all the tribes to have taken over Malchus, Levi, which is the Kohanim and Leviim, were the least appropriate, right? Because what we have here really is, if you want to translate that into modern terms, right? What Yaakov Avinu wanted was something which was called later on in the 20th century, or even in the American Constitution, in the 18th century, the separation of church and state. What does that mean? That we want to have military powers and religious authority separate from each other. We don't want the same person to have both religious authority and military power, because that's a formula for disaster. The founding fathers of America understood this principle, and that's why they instituted in the Constitution a separation of church and state. But the person who understood this the first was Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov Avinu understood that among his children, the tribe of Levi would be responsible for the Leviim and the Kohanim, responsible for the Beis HaMikdash, and they would have ultimate religious responsibility. Yehuda would be the king and have military and economic responsibility, and the two should not be together in the one person. And that lasted from the time of Yaakov Avinu all the way until the Chanukah story. By the time you get to the Chanukah story, you suddenly have something terrible. Terrible in the eyes of Jewish values, which is you have a king who rules the military and the economy of the country, who is dressed in the clothes of the Kohen, and sometimes even of the Kohen Gadol, all in one person. And for example, the story, the Gemara in Kiddushin relates about Yanai HaMelech. Yanai HaMelech, who was one of, Alexander Yanai, one of the most famous of the Hasmonean kings, who would dress up at public events. He would appear as the king, dressed up in the clothes of the Kohen Gadol. So he was trying to bring together these two sources of status and authority. And that was in violation of this principle that Yaakov Avinu had established, right? And this was a total disaster. So the Ramban is telling us, let's go back to the Ramban just for a minute. The Ramban is telling us that this was, so look what the Ramban says. Ki hoyu chaside elia. Look what the Ramban here gives us, an amazing approbation of who were the Chashmonaim. They were Chaside Elio. They were great spiritual leaders. The Ilmole Haim, look at this language here. The Ilmole Haim, if it wasn't for them, if it wasn't for the Chashmonaim, look at this language of the Ramban. Nishtakcha HaTorah HaMitzvahs MiYisrael. Torah and mitzvahs would have been forgotten from Israel. So the revolt of the Chashmonaim, says the Ramban, was something magnificent. And they are heroes of Klal Yisrael, but they made a mistake, a tragic mistake. Right? So if you think about it for a minute, what is the Ramban saying? He's saying they should have won the revolt and gone back to being Kohanim. And now there was a new sovereign Jewish state. They should have found a suitable descendant of Yehuda and put him on the throne and established Malchus Yisrael. Yehuda could have been sitting on the throne of Israel, and then the Ramban says, Jewish history would have been different. That would have been different. That would have been a moment when the Chashmonaim would have remained true to the values of Yaakov Avinu and to the values of Torah and Mitzvahs. So you have here, it's a very interesting idea, generally in Jewish history, something worth mentioning, that the great heroes of Klal Yisrael, we never try and whitewash their errors. Even Moshe, the errors of Moshe Rabbeinu, and the errors of David HaMelech and Shlomo HaMelech. The Torah emphasizes again and again that these were human beings who were fallible, and their greatness was magnificent, but their errors were tragic. And the errors of David HaMelech and of Shlomo HaMelech and of Moshe Rabbeinu were tragic and had tragic consequences. The same is true about the Hanukkah story. It says the Ramban that the Hashmonaim were Hasidei Elyon. Elyon means of the highest possible level, spiritual leaders, and what they did was unbelievable. They preserved Torah and Mitzvahs. It's as simple as that. Without them, we would have been lost, the Masorah. Don't forget, incidentally, at that point in Jewish history, the Masorah of Torah Shebaal Peh had not yet been written down. And because it hadn't been written down yet, it only existed where? Where did Torah Shebaal Peh exist? It only existed in the minds of the Torah scholars, of the Talmidei Chachamim. That's where it existed. If they would have been killed by the Greeks, or if they would have been banished and lost, and their teaching would have been lost, which is what the Greeks wanted to do, they outlawed the teaching of Torah, and they killed people who were teaching Torah Barabim, right? If we would have lost that oral tradition, the whole of Judaism would be lost. Because we all know that Torah Shebichtav, the written Torah, the Posuk in the Chumash and in the Tanakh, is really only half of Judaism. It's literally, I often say, that this is a fantastic example of what is referred to in English as the tip of the iceberg. The iceberg is 9/10 underneath the water, and only the tip is visible. And that's true about Torah as well. Only 1/10 of Torah is visible above the water, and that's Torah Shebichtav, the written words of the Chumash. But 9/10 is the Mishnah and the Gemara and the Rishonim and Acharonim and the Paiskim. Torah Shebaal Peh is below the water. Fortunately, by the time it came to Yehuda Anasi, he wrote it down, and he only wrote it down because he felt it would be lost completely. But at the time of the Hanukkah story, that's what the Ramban means. If indeed the Greeks would have been successful, that would have been it. It would have been the end of a Masorah of Torah Shebaal Peh, and there'd be no Mishnah, and no Gemara, and no Torah Shebaal Peh, and no Judaism. And therefore, the Hashmonaim did, on the one hand, the most magnificent heroic act of saving Klal Yisrael and saving Torah, and at the same time, they went on, once they had power, they were not able to relinquish power. This is a very human, it's a human ego issue. Once somebody is given power, right, and they were the victors, right, to then say, right, we've got this power, thank you very much. We're now going to hand over the power to the authentic people who should be holding this power. They weren't able or willing to do that. That is the Ramban. Okay. So now I'd like to discuss something with you just for a minute. So first of all, I want to show you, I haven't really got as much time as I thought I would have, but that's true every year. So he says, I'd like to show you that if you look at the Ramban, right, this is Maimonides, right, also the other great commentator and scholar of the 12th century. So he tells the story about the Hanukkah story, Mabayis Sheini, Molcho Yavon, etc., Gozu Guzeres in Israel, Ubitlu Dosom, and they didn't allow them to learn Torah, etc., all the things that is mentioned here. Right, and what happened was, but now I want to look at this. Vatzar lahem liYisrael, you can read it in English. Vatzar lahem liYisrael ma'od mipneihem, the people of Israel were under great stress because of the Greeks. And until what happened, HaKadosh Baruch Hu made rachmanis on them. HaKadosh Baruch Hu Rachmanos, Voshia Miyodom, and saved them. And how did he do that? V'govru b'nei HaChashmonai HaKanim HaGdolim V'horgu. And the sons of the Chashmonai, of the Kohen Gadol, they were victorious. And Voshia Miyodom, and so now the Rambam tells, what did they achieve? So the first thing he says is, the most important thing is, Voshia Yisrael Miyodom. And the Kohanim saved Klal Yisrael from the persecution of the Greeks, and from then on, one was able to practice Torah and mitzvahs without fear of persecution. But now look at the next line in the Rambam. And I want to say to you, the next line of the Rambam, you can see that the Rambam disagrees with the Ramban. The Ramban has just got through saying that it was a terrible aveira to establish a king of the Chashmonaim. But here the Rambam is giving us a list of their great achievements. And he says here, V'hemidu melech min ha-Kohanim. They established a king from the family of Kohanim, V'chozra malchus li-Yisrael. And Jewish sovereignty returned was restored to Israel for a period of more than two centuries, until the destruction of the Second Temple. So you can see here, I'm doing this a little bit quickly, but I hope you can get the point here, that what the Rambam includes in the list of great achievements of the Chashmonaim, which was to establish a malchus, a kingdom, from their own family, the Ramban sees this as an aveira. So this is a very interesting debate, an interesting discussion. Why indeed? What really, so the Ramban seems to be right. The Ramban is darshaning from a posuk. He's saying that they violated the rules of Yaakov Avinu. But we, who are learning Rambam and Ramban, we have the job of understanding why would the Rambam disagree with this? Why is the Rambam here saying that establishing the kingdom was also a big mitzvah and a big achievement and something positive? Why is that? So first of all, one could say, on a simple matter, this incidentally is what a lot of the learning in yeshivas revolves around, this particular methodology. If you look at the Rishonim, right, the early medieval commentaries on Chazal, and you see like the Rambam and the Ramban disagree with each other, then the question is, what is the point of, what is the nekudas hamachlokas? What is the issue over which they disagree? So you could say the issue is very simple, that Yaakov Avinu that the Ramban views that Yaakov was establishing rules which had to be obeyed. But it could be the Rambam simply understands that Yaakov Avinu was giving a Yehuda a bracha. He was saying to him, you should have the malchus, but he wasn't actually establishing new rules, right? And if under certain circumstances the malchus went to somebody else, that wasn't a big problem. But there's something much more interesting going on here. I'm a bit pressed for time. I want to share with you at least one little gem here, which is found in the writings of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, the Emes LeYaakov, one of the Gedolei Yisrael that I had the privilege to meet of the previous generations, Zichrono Livracha, a really amazing leader and educator, and one of the greatest Talmidei Chachamim of the previous generation, a very close personal friend of Rav Moshe Feinstein in America. So he writes like this, something very interesting. He says that there is, if we want to justify why the Rambam understands that the Chashmonaim were right to establish the Malchus, it's as follows. He says, there was a danger, a danger in Klal Yisrael, that by re-establishing Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel, people might think, What might they think? They might think, it's Mashiach. This is the time of Mashiach. Here we are living in Israel. We've got a Beis HaMikdash, right? Right? Until then, what were they missing? They were only missing the fact that they were living under Greek rule. They weren't sovereign. But the minute we have our own sovereignty and a descendant of David HaMelech is sitting on the throne, that's it. That's Mashiach. This is the Geula Acharona. This is the Geula Acharona, and they'd be wrong. And this would confuse people, says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. It was very important for the Hashmonaim not to mislead Klal Yisrael. It was indeed a great victory, but Golos was still ahead of us, and they knew that. They knew that the Bais Sheni wouldn't last forever. The Second Temple was only going to be a temporary affair. They knew that. And they knew that there wasn't, that this was not Mashiach time. And they were worried that if they would put a descendant of Yehuda, of David HaMelech, on the throne, it would confuse people, says Rabbi Yochanan Kamenetsky. That's why the Rambam holds that this was not an Aveira, it was the right thing to do. Coming back now to something I mentioned at the beginning of the Shia, because I can see we're coming to the end of the Shia, I mentioned at the beginning of the Shia a mystery. Why is it that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, in the Second Temple, in the second century, why, when he was writing the Mishnah, why did he not write Mishnayos about Hanukkah? So this is an idea which is mentioned, I said it was debated, the Vilna Gaon, the Chasam Sofer, this is brought down by the Talmidim. I'm not sure exactly what the source for this is, but it's brought down in several places by the Talmidim of the Chasam Sofer. Says that the Gemara says that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi was a direct descendant of David HaMelech, right? And he was called Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, Rabbi Yehuda the Prince, and he was the Nasi of Klal Yisrael. He was the prince of the Jewish people in the second century, right? Under Roman rule, of course, it's after the destruction of the Second Temple, but he still felt very strongly that he represented David HaMelech. And because of that, he represented this principle that every generation should have leadership from David HaMelech. Because of that, he felt that the Hanukkah story had a major problem to it, that his ancestors had been sidelined, that the tribe of Yehuda hadn't been given their due respect. And that's why he couldn't write a Mishnah about it. The Chasam Sofer says, when Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi wrote the Mishnah, he was writing with Ruach HaKodesh. He wrote the Mishnah. The Mishnah is not just a text of do's and don'ts and one thing and another. The Mishnah is Teresh Baal Peh, written with Ruach HaKodesh, written as part of the Kisvei Kodesh of the Jewish people. The whole of the Talmud is based on the writings of the Mishnah, every single word. But when he wrote about Hanukkah, he felt angry. He was angry with that. Hanukkah's story was a story which angered the descendants of Yehuda, because that was a massive, if you like, disrespect to the tribe of Yehuda and a rejection of their authority. And therefore, he couldn't write the Mishnah. He couldn't write it. He was unable, says the Chasam Sofer, to write the Mishnah down because of this problem that the Ramban is mentioning, that the Hashmonaim acted in violation of the status of Yehuda and David HaMelech. And that's why we don't have a Mishnah, right? Because we do know, if you look at the Gemara and Shabbos, we do know that this is the... that there was Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel famously disputed about whether one should light candles 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 the way we do it, or 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Beis Shammai said, no, you light candles in descending order, not in ascending order, right? So that debate took place between Shammai and Hillel. So that could have been a Mishnah. Why is it not in the Mishnah? Why is it only recorded in the Gemara? So that is one of the reasons. That's exactly right, that the Gemara says that a person can only have Ruach HaKodesh if he is besimcha, if he's basically feeling he's balanced and he's living a life besimcha, then he can have the Ruach HaKodesh. But if you're angry, you can't write with Ruach HaKodesh. A person who has anger loses his divine inspiration. That's well known. The truth is, if you get angry, you lose your marbles completely anyhow. You lose your whole seichel, you lose everything. Once you get angry, right? Allowing yourself to get angry, the Rambam says, is the worst. You're abandoning your whole, all your rational faculties are completely short-circuited if you allow yourself to get angry. Yehuda HaNasi was not a man who got angry, but when he started to try to write down the Hanukkah halachas, he was upset. He was too upset to write it all down. And therefore, we don't have in the Mishnah any halachas about Hanukkah, but by the time he came to the writing of the Gemara, they recorded everything. The Gemara recorded absolutely everything. Absolutely everything was written down in the Gemara, and then it's talking about the lights of Shabbos. It says, you know what, there are certain wicks and oils So I'd just like to end up with telling you one beautiful line of the Gemara there. The Gemara says, the wicks and the oils, which are forbidden to use on Shabbos, are only forbidden because they don't burn very well. And they could easily flutter and stutter and be give an unshaky light. And there's a danger that on Shabbos you might come to adjust the flame or adjust the light, and that would be forbidden on Shabbos, right? And therefore, you must use on Shabbos only something which is a smooth, unfluttering light and a flow of oil to the wick. But the Gemara says, but those oils and wicks which are not allowed on Shabbos are allowed on Chanukah. You can use them for Chanukah, because on Chanukah, it doesn't matter if the light flickers. You can adjust it. There's no problem on Chanukah. And the Gemara says even on Shabbos Chanukah you can use it, because since you're not allowed to use the light anyway, you're not allowed to use the light. Therefore, we're not worried that you will come to adjust the light. So you see there something very interesting, the contrast. So I just want to add to you, and this is my closing minute for the Shia, that the Gedolei HaChassidus, the Sfas Emes and the Kotzka Rebbe wrote that there is a remez in this piece of Gemara, that actually the light of Shabbos and the light of Chanukah are two different lights. And the light of Shabbos is a light which is extremely powerful, but it doesn't reach every member of Klal Yisrael. Because there are some members of Klal Yisrael who are not Shomer Shabbos, who can't manage to see the light of Shabbos, right? So he says, even those, so what does Bameh Madrikim mean? How do you ignite the soul of another Jew? How do you inspire somebody else to be proud of being Jewish, to be proud of keeping mitzvahs, to want to keep more mitzvahs and increase their Judaism? Bameh Madlikin, how do you light somebody up? Says the Kotzka Rebbe, the light of Shabbos is very delicate and doesn't reach everybody. But the light of Chanukah reaches even those people who are not reached by the light of Shabbos. You know, I think in the world we are living in today, if you walk around on Chanukah, you will see that even people in Israel who are not Shomer Shabbos, who don't understand the light of Shabbos, who don't see the light of Shabbos, but Madlikim Bahem B'Chanukah, Chanukah does light them up. Chanukah has part of the Or Ein Sof, the infinite light of the Kedusha of Klal Yisrael is in the lights of Chanukah. And somehow, this Chag of Chanukah reaches even those people who are not reached by the lights of Shabbos, and we dafka put our menorah in the window, at the doorpost, in order to shine out the light into the Rishus HaRabim, into the public domain, in the hope of igniting the souls of every single member of Klal Yisrael. There's nobody in Klal Yisrael, as the Kotzka Rebbe, who cannot be touched by the light of the menorah of Chanukah. And because of that, the lights of Chanukah are the most magnificent, if you like, mechanism for transmitting Pirsumei Nisa, transmitting Jewish pride, Jewish confidence, the beauty and the spiritual nature of Jewish life is all radiated out in Chanukah. And even those oils and wicks, which are too complicated, and therefore you can't use them on Shabbos, you can use them on Chanukah, because on Chanukah we reach everybody. And this is a very beautiful thought I'd like to end up with today. Bez Hashem, the light of Chanukah should indeed shine through our homes, and shine not just through our homes, but shine out of our homes to Am Yisrael, and inspire and cheer up everybody. And I'll just end up with a Yiddish greeting. So in Hebrew, they say Chanukah Sameach. In Yiddish, they wish each other a lichtiger Chanukah, which means a light, a Chanukah which is lit up, a lighting up Chanukah. So I wish you all a lichtiger Chanukah.